I reached a hand out to run across the impossibly clean pillow, but my fingers curled back without my meaning them to. I'd bathed that morning, at proper baths, too. I'd poured oil into my hair and dragged a comb through it with my head under water until it wasn't matted anymore. The steam had wound its way around the swirling tiled patterns of the bath, making my hair curl out. But I still felt like I was going to track the whole desert in with me, like the sand was too deep in my skin after nearly 17 years. A whistle split my ears. An alarm? I scrambled to my feet and back to the other side of the room, gun already in my hand, pointing at the door. I waited for it to fly open. For 2 long heartbeats, nothing happened, though there was a lot of commotion outside. And then the whole room lurched sideways. I pitched so hard to the right that I sat down hard on the bed, narrowly keeping my finger from hitting the trigger. I clutched the bed while the train stammered a few more times and then started to move, smoother now. I hadn't really thought about what riding a train would feel like, the same as riding a horse, I'd figured. I was sure wrong on that count. I sat on the bed, feeling the train pick up speed for a few moments before I got to my feet. All I could see out of the window was black smoke filling the station. Then, in a violent heave, we broke free. Smoke rushed up, sucked toward the desert sky. My window cleared. I rested my forehead against the glass. For once, the desert didn't seem like it went on forever. The horizon was racing up. A grin stretched the bruise on my cheek painfully. I was on my way to Isman. I lay on the soft bed, being rocked pleasantly by the motion of the train. The room darkened as the sun made its way from one side of the carriage to the other. Eventually, my stomach started to growl hungrily. I ignored it as long as I could, but it was a week's journey to Isman. I'd have to leave my compartment sooner or later. The train was bustling when I stepped outside. Women in fine clothes brushed by me in the corridors, and men stood laughing and slapping one another on the back with hands so heavy with rings, it was a wonder they could hold them up. I caught myself dragging my hand across the thick red wallpaper as I made my way down the train. I shoved my hand in my pocket. That wasn't the gesture of someone who belonged in first class. I passed out of the sleeping area and into a carriage that seemed to be a bar. Nothing like the dark, dusty one in Sazi. This one was blazing with light, the ceiling stained dark with thick pipe smoke. Laughter exploded among a group of men over a card table as I passed. Beyond it was a dining carriage. I hovered uncertainly in the doorway for a moment before a man in a uniform came and ushered me to a table. Dark leather gave way under my back as I settled uneasily in a chair by the window. The chair squeaked below me every time I shifted. A woman at the next table looked up at the noise as I tried to make myself comfortable, sitting as still as I could. Being by myself, surrounded by strangers instead of the folks I'd known my whole life, I was still getting used to it. Best not to draw attention. If anyone looked my way, they might wonder why there was a scruffy boy still wrapped in his shima, eating among their glittering clothes. Colorfully painted plates piled high with food were laid out for me. I eased my shima away from my mouth, keeping an eye on anyone who might be watching too closely. But everybody else was looking at their own food. I kept my head down as I shoveled a forkful into my mouth. I almost gagged with surprise on the huge bite. Spices like these were worth a month's wages in Dustwalk. I chewed and swallowed before downing the glass of arrak that had been set out for me. The second, smaller bite was better, since I was expecting it. Soon I was shoveling mouthfuls in fast. I was scraping the fork along the pattern of the plate when they came and took it away. One plate followed another. By the time I licked the last of the honey from the baklava off my fingers, I was full to bursting and tired. Sleeping away the afternoon heat wasn't a luxury we could afford in Dust Walk, but I'd seen it done in Sazi when the streets emptied of the wealthy who drew in behind their cool walls. It looked like they honored the tradition here. Folks were slipping back into their own compartments or settling back on the cushions in the dining carriage to close their eyes. I retreated to my own compartment, kicking the door shut behind me. I tugged off my boots and collapsed on top of the clean linens. In a week, we'd be in Isman. By then, I'd have to figure out how to eat and dress and act like I was supposed to in the big city. Until then, though, I could do whatever the hell I wanted. Chapter 9. I woke in the dark. The thin light that still lingered outside the curtains of my compartment told me the sun had only just set. The full weight of the desert night hadn't descended yet. Folks would just be waking up again to eat dinner. The meal was still resting heavy in my stomach, and the jolting of the train wasn't helping. The compartment felt close and hot, even after the sun set. I needed clean air. I tried the window, but it was sealed shut, as best I could figure from scrabbling at the edges. I bought a few changes of clothes in Juniper City. I pulled on a fresh shirt, reveling in the cool against my skin before venturing out into the hall. It was quiet, the carriage still heavy with the afternoon's sleep. Though some of the stifled noises through doors suggested a few folks doing something other than resting. I pulled the nearest window open as far as it would give and let the cooling desert air rush in. Since the hallway was empty, I pulled my shima free so my face was exposed as I leaned my forehead against the glass pane. I stayed there, taking deep breaths, settling the rich food in my stomach. The rush of air, like I was running toward Isman, toward adventure, faster than ever, made me feel that I was finally moving. A door clattered open behind me. My hand was halfway to pulling my shima up when I caught sight of a familiar face. I froze like a fox caught in the henhouse. Stepping through the door, head tipped forward as she fastened the top button of a new pink and yellow kalat, tousled black hair tumbling over her shoulders, was Shira. The sight of her was so familiar that it stuck out like a rusty barb here in this new place. She didn't see me. She took another step without looking, expecting the world to get out of her way as usual. Her step took her nearly straight into me. Only then did she look up. She was close enough that I could see the biting comment shaping in her mouth. Her lips parted in a surprised O, and then split into a jackal's smile. Cousin! I had my gun pointed at her face before the end of the word left her mouth. Don't scream. I was already looking for an escape. Why would I? There was a mocking in her voice as she clasped her hands behind her back, leaning idly against the wall. You're not going to shoot me. How do you figure? I shifted my finger on the trigger. It's a sin to kill your own flesh and blood. She made a pouting face. See, I paid attention in prayers. What are you doing here, Shira? I checked over my shoulder as quick as I could, without taking my eyes off her long enough for her to get up to anything. Somebody might stumble through any moment and see us. She rolled her eyes skyward. Did you honestly think you were the only one who wanted a life outside that useless little town? Truth be told, I'd never given a moment of thought to what Shira might want. I'd reckon she was the same as anyone, stupidly content to stay in Dust Walk. Fazim and I used to talk about a future where we were rich and we had all the things we wanted in the world. Only it seems Fazim didn't much care about who got him rich in the end. There was still a mark on my wrist where Fazim had grabbed me. So I'm making my fortune without him, and that charming young commander who busted up your face was nice enough to take me with him. I knew you'd be here, cousin. How could you know that? She raised one shoulder coyly. Well, you don't sleep 3 feet from someone and not know a thing or two. That was true. I knew Shira liked wearing yellow, hated the taste of pickled lemons, and played with her hair when she was lying. And Shira knew I'd head for Isman if I ever got out of Dustwalk. But there was no way in hell or earth she could know I'd be on this train. Even if there was only one train a month. So what does that get you? I asked, knowing that. I'll show you, cousin. She smiled like we were both in on some big joke, and then she took a deep lungful of air and screamed. Before I could run, the door of the nearest compartment crashed open in answer, spilling Nagib out. It was the same one Shira had just tiptoed out of. Nagib looked younger with his uniform jacket missing, his shirt unbuttoned at the throat. His eyes went wide when he saw me.
Help! I found her! Shira screeched. The traitor can't be far. Help!
I wasted a precious second wishing a good lie would come. My tongue failed me. My legs couldn't afford to. I grabbed Shira and moved at the same moment the train pitched sideways. The force sent Shira careening backward into the young commander with a cry. He caught her clumsily. I flung myself through the carriage door, ignoring the shouts behind me. I ran the length of the carriage, shoved past the passengers who'd started to emerge into the corridor, and through the next door, fumbling for a lock behind me. Anything to slow them down. Nothing. Cursing, I turned and kept running. Down and down until I was halfway through second class. I could still hear my pursuers. I was going to run out of train any minute now. I needed to figure out where I was going before I wound up in the sand. I'd worry about that when it happened. I flung myself against the door at the end of the carriage. It jammed. I rattled the handle, looking behind me for uniforms. I rammed my shoulder against the door again and again. Shouts were getting closer, though it was hard to tell over the rattling of the train. The door gave. Night air, rails, and sand rushed up to meet me as I pitched forward. I grabbed the doorframe, catching myself just in time. Where there'd been a walkway between the other carriages, here there was only a yawning gap with a narrow metal coupling linking the two cars. In the light from the carriage behind me, I could make out the rails whipping below my feet. The air lashed my clothes around me, invisible fingers trying to snatch me back to the sands where I belonged. There was another door across the way. I could make it through that. Probably. Only one way to find out. I leapt and hit the door full force. It gave way with a dull thud that sent me sprawling, battered and breathless, but alive, across the carriage floor. I pulled my dangling feet up behind me in a graceless scramble. The door swung shut, narrowly missing my toes. There was a lock this time, and I shoved the bolt into place and hurried to stand up. There were no more compartments here, just rows of bunks stacked one atop another all the way back. Dozens of passengers craned around the metal frames to stare at me. They looked like prisoners pressing desperate faces through iron bars. At least one of them was bound to give me up as soon as the soldiers got through the door. I dodged between beds. A game of dice and drink was underway between some men. They were sitting on the floor using a bunk like a table. Stained cards were spread out across the sheets, between handfuls of coins. I wove my way through the mass, looking for a place to hide. Four women huddle together on a single bunk, combing one another's hair and eating dates. A little boy with bare feet ran up and tried to grab one. He got a hairbrush to the knuckles and started to wail. I realized my shima was loose around my neck, my hair tumbling free, making me a girl again. A girl in boy's clothes. I went to wrap it back around my face. Even as I did, an arm latched around my waist, a hand over my mouth. My attacker pulled me free from the crowd and pushed me up against the train wall between two bunks. I looked up straight into a pair of familiar foreign eyes. "You," Jin said, pinning me in place, "are really something else." The panic dropped away. Jin might not look all that happy with me, but it was better than being caught by a soldier. I shoved him so his hand fell away from my mouth. "I'm going to go ahead and take that as a compliment. What are you doing here?"
"Searching this whole damn train for you," he said, sounding relieved.
"Well, you didn't make it to the front," I said.
"The front?"
He cocked his eyebrow questioningly, and then it hit him.
"You bought a first-class ticket? Why? How?"
Like hell I was going to admit it was a mistake. "I sold Xander," I said instead.
"Xander?"
Jin's grip loosened a little. "The Buraki," I explained, looking over his shoulder. It was just a matter of time until I'd see the flash of gold and white uniform.
"You named him Xander?"
There was something in his face, like he was trying to figure me out. "I had to call him something, and it's as good a name as any other. My uncle had a horse he named Blue. I don't know about you, but I've never seen a blue horse." I didn't know why I was getting defensive.
"So you named him after a prince who got himself turned into a horse by a genie 200 years ago?"
"Why does it matter how long ago it was?" I asked in exasperation. "It won't stick anyhow. I sold him. To this trader who called himself Oman Slick Hands, even though his palms just seemed sweaty to me. Only he wasn't exactly honest, because an honest trader would have turned me in for a girl."
"Or a blue-eyed thief."
Jin looked amused.
"I ought to turn you in."
"Well, you're going to have your chance soon enough, because the army is on this train, and they're after me just now. Or probably after you, but I'm in their way." Jin's head darted up, looking back the way I came.
"Fine," Jin said. "Give me the compass and I'll get us out of here."
"The compass?" I wasn't sure what I'd been expecting after he'd tracked me 3 days across the desert, but it wasn't this.
"You're too smart to play dumb, bandit."
Jin's eyes searched me, like I might be hiding his compass in plain sight. "You're mistaking my playing dumb for my thinking you're an idiot for wanting a beat-up compass." His hand was clamped firmly over my pulse.
"So we both know you took it. Give it back and we'll call it quits for poisoning me. I won't even ask you to pay me back half of the money for the Buraki you stole."
"I didn't poison you. I drugged you. And that Buraki was mine." I tried to pull my arm free, but he was stronger than I was. "You stole it first. If you hadn't set such a bad example, maybe I would have never stolen your broken compass."
"Broken?"
His hand tightened until it hurt. "Yeah." I struggled not to wince. He wasn't smiling anymore. "I rode all night in the wrong direction following the needle on that compass until the sun came up and straightened me out." I felt him relax against me.
If it's no good to you, then you won't miss it.
Seeing as it's no good to me, why would I have kept it?
Amani.
He leaned toward me until I could feel the heat of him in the small space.
Where is it?
I tightened my jaw. Soldiers are coming.
Then you'd better tell me fast, bandit.
I didn't speak right away. Our wills locked against each other. I wanted to lie to him, tell him it was gone with the Buraki, keep making him suffer for refusing to take me with him in Dustwalk, for saying I wasn't going to get to Isman in Sazi, for trying to keep me where I was when I was fighting so hard to break away.
Amani.
He lowered his voice, a real note of desperation in my name.
Please.
My anger came apart with a tug of his words. It's under my clothes,
I admitted finally.
He let go of me. I tugged my shirt up, too conscious of his eyes on me as I bared the skin of my hips to reach the cloth wrapped around my waist to pat it out. My hand slipped between cloth and skin and closed around the cool metal and glass. I let my shirt fall back into place as I pulled it out. The compass was a battered brass thing. The glass was scratched and chipped on one edge. The needle swung back and forth over a background of a blue sky the same color as my eyes, dotted with painted yellow stars. I figured it might be of value. His expression shifted as his hand closed over the compass, locking it between our hands. The tension fled his body, and he leaned his forehead into mine, catching me off guard. I could smell the desert on him.
Thank you,
he said. His eyes were closed, but mine were wide open. This close, and I could make out the smallest scar on his upper lip. I was keenly aware of our breathing mixing in the closeness. It would take almost nothing to lean forward and press my mouth to that scar. There was a crash and a shout from the other end of the carriage. Jin's eyes flew open. What I'd been saying about the soldiers seemed to register on his face at last.
Come on.
He started to lead me out from between the bunks.
Let's...
White and gold flashed across the carriage, out of place among the dingy third-class passengers. Too late. There was no time to run and even less time to think. We needed to hide. Only there was nowhere to hide, except exactly where we were standing. I yanked Jin back toward me. My knuckles skimmed over the edge of the sun tattooed over his heart. That was the last thing I noticed before I kissed him. His jaw tensed in surprise for a moment. His hand gripped my arm hard enough to hurt. And then his body was flush against mine, pushing my back against the wall of the train. I was a desert girl. I thought I knew heat. I was wrong. The contact sent a rush through me so sudden, I started to pull away before I caught fire. But Jin trapped my face in his hands. There was nowhere to run to. Nowhere to go. Nowhere I wanted to go. I hadn't really thought this through, but now I didn't have any thoughts left. Only the strength of his fingers against my neck. His breath vibrated through me until I couldn't feel anything anymore except want. More than want. Need. His thumb struck the place where Naguib's gun had hit me. An involuntary hiss escaped my lips. Jin broke away and the moment cracked. Cold air rushed into the gap between our bodies, filling the place his hands had been on my skin a moment before. Now they were planted flat against the wall on either side of me. His eyes weren't on me anymore. They were on the gun at my hip. I saw a flash of a uniform through the space under his arm. His body wasn't pressed to me. Wasn't wanting me, I reminded myself. Only hiding me. I was breathing like someone who'd never had enough air. Somewhere at the bottom of my lungs, I found words again. They're not out of sight yet. Jin didn't look at me.
No.
His arms were planted on either side of my head against the rattling carriage wall. He bent toward me just a little, and my body tugged toward him.
They're not.
Someone slapped him on the back, and the world careened back in.
How much is she charging, friend?
One bunk over, someone laughed. At the other end of the carriage, a head that might have belonged to a soldier turned at the sound. Jin grabbed my hand.
Let's get out of here.
The door I'd come through was still open. I was about to tell him it was no good heading back that way, that we didn't have anywhere to hide. Then his arms were around my waist. I didn't have time to say a thing before he jumped. Chapter 10. For a sliver of an instant, I was flying. Then rails flashed in the edge of my vision, narrowly missing a chance to get better acquainted with my skull. My ribs and the ground weren't so shy. We hit the sand hard. Air burst out of my lungs. We rolled one over the other, Jin's grip tight around me, the train screaming in my ears, drowning out everything I wanted to shout back. Finally, we stopped in a bank of sand. I shoved Jin off me, an ache spreading from my shoulder to my hips. He cursed, clutching his side, but I was ready to run as fast as the train until I caught up. I was on my feet just in time for night and black smoke to swallow the last of the gleaming metal carriages. For one crazy second, I thought about running behind and grabbing hold, riding for days hooked onto the back of a train. But the train was gone, carrying hundreds of people away to Isman, without me. And I felt something rupture inside. I wrapped my arms around my ribs to keep it in.
You all right?
Jin was watching me, clutching his side.
Amani?
The way he said my name in a long exhale set me off like a spark in a powder keg. I swung my fist straight for his face. Jin grabbed my wrist before my knuckles could get flirting distance from his nose. He pulled me into him, knocking me off balance.
Here's a tip for you.
He was close to me now, close as he had been when he kissed me, or when I kissed him.
Don't try to hit a man in the face when he's looking straight into your eyes. You've got traitor eyes, bandit.
I drove my other fist into his gut hard enough that my knuckles popped. Jin doubled over, coughing. Thanks for the tip. I wished victory didn't feel so much like I'd sprained my hand.
Any time.
He clutched his stomach where I'd hit him, but it looked like he was laughing. I had the wild urge to hit him again while he was down. Instead, I drew my shirt up, pulling the gun out of where it was tied against my hip.
We should start walking, Jin said. We're probably less than a day out of Masil. We'll have to follow the rails. We could be there before the sun gets too high if we start now.
What makes you think I'm going anywhere with you? If it weren't for his having an army on his tail, I'd still be on the way to Isman. Of course, if it weren't for him, I'd also still be in Dustwalk. But I wasn't going to get into that just now. I shoved my gun back in my belt. No need to hide it here. Better for folks to know I was armed.
You got a better plan?
Jin waved his arm at the empty desert like he was offering me a feast for fools.
Would you rather strike off across the desert and wind up food for buzzards than walk another day with me?
He wasn't wrong. It was open nothingness as far as the eye could see all around us, except for the rails that ran like an iron scar through the sand. There were only two ways to go if I wanted to stay alive. Forward with him, back to Juniper City. I wasn't going back. Don't flatter yourself. I riffled my fingers through my hair, pulling it loose from where it was trapped under my shima as I started to walk. You're not near worth dying over. We walked in silence as night crept its way across the sky. My anger kept me three steps ahead of Jin as we walked. But even that fire started to dim as the night wore on. I told myself over and over again there'd been another way. We could have stayed on the train, found somewhere to hide, something. After a few hours of turning it over and over in my head, though, I couldn't think of anything else that we could have done except jump. It was hard to stay angry at someone who'd saved your life. We'd been walking near all night when I noticed the other figure. I thought it was a trick of the hazy gray pre-dawn light. The uncertain times between day and night, where neither God nor the Destroyer of Worlds had true dominion, were the most dangerous. But no, down the rails, someone was walking toward us. I dropped to the sand on instinct, flattening myself into the landscape. Jin was down next to me in a second without question. What is it? He had the sense to keep his voice low as he crawled up next to me on his elbows. Someone is coming. I nodded ahead. All I could make out was a silhouette on foot coming in our direction. It could just be a lone desert nomad leaving Maciel as we were going in. Or it could be that someone in the third-class carriage had told the soldiers they'd seen a girl dressed as a boy and a foreigner jump off the train. The same thought clearly occurred to Jin. Come on. He started to push himself forward on his elbows to stay close to the sand, moving away from the rails. We'd been walking between them, from one wooden slat to the next, so there'd be no tracks. I crawled behind Jin, kicking any marks from our bodies away with my boot. We crested a sand dune. I rolled over to the other side, flattening myself on my front so we were hidden from the rails. I loosened my gun just in case. Jin already had a knife in his hand. We lay in the sand in silence, side by side. I could feel the desert shifting below my stomach with every breath. I listened for the sound of passing footsteps. That was the trouble with sand, it muffled most noises. We never hear him climbing up the dune until he was on top of us. We outnumbered him, but surprise made a single man dangerous. It probably wasn't a soldier, I realized. Soldiers didn't tend to travel alone. But that still left 100 dangerous possibilities. A hungry skinwalker. A greedy desert bandit. A genie. No, that was ridiculous. It couldn't be a ghoul. The iron ought to keep them away. And no one had seen a genie for decades. They didn't live among us like they used to anymore. But they were immortal. And this was the desert. The true open desert. Legend said things were out here that hadn't been seen by civilizations in decades. The unknown made me itch to clamber over the dune and take a look. I shifted ever so slightly, inching my way up the dune. Jin hissed a warning under his breath. I pressed the gun to my lips to silence him and remind him I was armed and likely a better shot than whoever was on the rails. He didn't reach out to stop me as I pulled myself the rest of the way up. The rails were as empty as a drunk's liquor bottle on prayer day. There's no one there. They've gone past. Or they'd vanished in a column of smokeless fire like the genie in the stories. Do you have a death wish? Jin sounded almost impressed, his voice returning to a normal volume as he sat up. "If I did, I wouldn't be very good at it, seeing as I'm still alive," I said, holstering my pistol.
"God knows how."
Jin scrubbed his hands over his face, tiredly. I was dead tired, too. It hit me all at once.
"Didn't anyone ever tell you the story of impulsive Atiya and the genie Sakaar when you were a child?"
"You mean the genie Zia," I corrected him absently.
"What?"
"It's Atiya and Zia. It rhymes. Who's ever heard of Sakaar?" I argued. Everybody knew the story of Atiya, the impulsive girl who was always getting herself into trouble, and her genie lover Zia, who feared so much for her life that he gave her his name. His true name, which she could speak, and he would be summoned to her rescue. That she could use to bind him to her will. The name that she could whisper to the lock of any door, and it would open into his secret kingdom.
"You think the point of the story is the genie's name?"
"No, but I reckon you ought to get it right." "She died because she said his name wrong in the story, not because she was impulsive. And why are we arguing about this?" I snapped. We both went silent.
"Is your aunt and his mom really worth your life?"
he asked finally. "I don't know. I've never met her." Jin stopped, hands caught midway through his hair. He'd shoved his shirt up to his elbows, and I saw the tension in the muscles in his forearms as he scrutinized me.
"You're going to Isman to find someone you've never met?"
"I'm going to Isman because it's got to be a better life than out here."
"No, it doesn't," Jin said. "Cities are worse, if anything. It's not like Dustwalk, where everybody knows your name and kills you for a good reason. They'll kill you for no reason at all. And that'd be a crying shame. You're too remarkable to waste as a corpse in a gutter."
He got to his feet and offered me a hand. I ignored it. I ignored what he'd said about me being remarkable, too.
"You sound like my father,"
I said, standing up without his help.
"Your father?"
He dropped his hand. "He used to say the city was for thieves and whores and politicians." I mocked my father's slurred tones with a wave of an imaginary drink. "I was better off staying where my family was going to keep me safe. Do you want to know how safe my father kept me?"
"What happened to him?"
Jin asked. There was a tense note in his voice that I couldn't read. "My mother killed him." He opened his mouth. "And don't bother to say you're sorry. He was an ass, and he wasn't my real father anyway." I thought back to the blue-eyed soldier who'd been working for Commander Naguib and wondered how many half-gallon children there were in the desert. No others that I knew of, but I hadn't exactly traveled far. Until now.
"I was going to say that it sounds like he deserved it," Jin said. "And your mother?"
His voice said he already knew. "What normally happens to murderers?" Sometimes in my nightmares, I still saw her swinging from a rope. I squared my shoulders. Let him tell me she deserved it, like everybody else had.
"That I am sorry for," he said. "A mother is a hard thing to lose."
I got the feeling he might know something about dead mothers. "I've got nothing to go back to," I admitted. "My Aunt Sophia in Isman is all I've got. So why not Isman?" He didn't answer me right away. There was some kind of war behind his eyes.
Fine, he said on a long, resigned exhale. Here's what we do.
He dropped to his knees and started sketching a lopsided triangle in the sand that I gathered was meant to be Miraji.
We walk to Masil. Here.
He jabbed at a point at the bottom of the triangle.
Trains are the only way to get through the mountains this time of year, and I don't suppose you have enough money left to wait around for the next one.
He looked to me for confirmation as he drew a jagged line across Masil, cutting us off from Isman.
First-class tickets are expensive, I admitted.
But, he went on, there'll be caravans preparing for the journey across the Sand Sea, toward the port cities on the northwest coast.
That's where your compass was pointing, I prodded.
His hat tipped over his face hid any answer from me.
And they'll be hiring.
Hiring what? I asked.
Muscle.
He shrugged.
Guns. Your desert's not all that safe, you know. The crossing is nothing but sand from Masil to Dasama.
He pointed at another dot he'd made in the top left of the triangle, north and west.
It's a month of walking.
It's also the wrong direction from Isman. I scuffed the top right corner with my toe, give or take where I knew the capital was. He gave me an exasperated look that told me to shut up and let him finish.
From Dasama, it's another 10 days of walking across the plains. The caravans do some trading on the way, so it can take longer. Then you get to the sea. It's 2 days sailing to Isman. You can buy your way across with wages from the caravan. What do you say, bandit?
You sure didn't miss your calling as a map maker. I looked at the muddled lines in the sand on which he'd sketched out our path. It seemed easy drawn out like that, but I knew better than to underestimate the desert. It's a lot harder than a train.
It came out as an accusation.
Yes,
but with fewer soldiers who want to kill you.
Jin stood up, brushing the sand off his hands onto his clothes. It was such a foreign thing to do. The gesture of somebody who wasn't used to sand getting into everything, who was still trying to fight it.
They want you, I reminded him. I'm just trying to get to Isman in one piece.
I had to admit, it was the best plan I had. He seemed to know Miraji better than I did, and I'd be lying if I said I didn't want to carry on with him, and lying was a sin. But something was nagging at me all the same.
I suppose you want me to think it's a coincidence that the best way across the desert is the way your compass is pointing?
I want a lot of things, Bandit. To get out of this goddamn country of yours, a cold bath, a decent meal.
Jin trailed off, and for just a moment I could have sworn his eyes drifted to me.
But what we need is to start walking if we want to be in Masil before we die of thirst. So what do you say, Bandit?
He stuck his hand out.
Stick together.
My hand fit well in his. Chapter 11 Jin was standing motionless in the middle of the ring, the muscles across his bare back glistening with sweat as they rose and fell. He let his opponent circle him. The other man dove at Jin, who caught him and slammed him to the ground. I heard the cracking of the man's nose just before the cheers drowned anything else out.
He can throw a hit as well as take one. I'll give him that.
Parviz of the Camel's Knees Caravan ran his knuckles along his jaw as he watched Jin's opponent wipe his bloody nose. I snorted, pitching my voice low to go with my disguise. I was a boy again tonight. No matter how many noses Jin turned bloody, no one was going to take us on as hired muscle so long as I was a girl. And we needed a caravan to get across the sand sea without dying of thirst. It had taken us a day of walking and all our supplies to get to Masil. What was left of our money we spent getting into the city. It was 5 fuzah for every camel to enter the ancient walls, and 3 fuzah for every person. The cost of a life told you all you needed to know about a place, especially in the trader city, where everything was a commodity. Here, human life was the cheapest thing going. Those were Jin's words as we passed beneath a huge stone arch into the once glorious city. Even I knew the story of Masil. A wise and powerful genie once ruled there, back when it was the greatest city on the edge of the small sea. The genie fell in love with the daughter of one of the traders and offered him the whole city in exchange for her hand. The girl was already promised to another trader from far across the small sea, but the greedy father wanted the city, so he fashioned a living doll of wax and magic to trick the genie while marrying his daughter to the trader. When the genie discovered the trick, he had already given the man the city, and Jean were only able to tell the truth, which meant they were bound by their word. Unable to take the city back, he raised a sandstorm so great that the sea filled up and up and up until the water was swallowed and there was nothing but sand as far as the eye could see. And then he vanished, leaving the worthless city on the edge of the desert to the greedy merchant. Masil, the last bastion of civilization before the sand sea crossing. The crowd roared as Jin landed a punch on his opponent's face with a crunch that set him down to the ground again. No more civilized than anywhere else, best I could see. You ought to see him in a real tight spot, I said to Parviz. I've seen him break a man's hand like that. I clicked my fingers, thinking of the noise Damod's wrist made when it cracked. Just then, Jin's opponent dove at him again. Jin sidestepped him, his leg lashing out, catching the man's knee and flipping him over to land flat in the sand. Parviz had a trader's face, even better than a gambler's. But I reckoned he was impressed.
He'd have to be able to fight if he's always got to be rescuing scrawny little brothers.
A voice chimed in from a few bodies over. I knew, before I made the mistake of raising my head, that the comment was meant for me. A boy with crooked front teeth had been trying to get a rise out of me all night. I reckoned he wanted me to take a swing at him so he could beat me up and impress some caravan leader without having to step into the ring and fight someone his own size. Jin might be able to hit him hard enough to straighten out his teeth, but I wasn't fixing to get my arm broken. Parviz turned to me and eyed me up against Jin.
He's your brother?
We had different mothers. Our charade was rickety as an old hen house, but it was the only thing we had that was likely to get us hired and across the desert without being picked apart by buzzards 2 days out.
We'll work for half of what the others are asking for, I said instead of answering the question.
We've been turned down twice already tonight, maybe on account of Jin's foreignness or my size. But the Camel's Knees clan had a reputation for being cheapskates.
I've been trading since I was high as a camel's knee.
Parviz chuckled at his own joke.
I can count well enough to know that with 2 of you, it works out the same fee as a single man, and then there's an extra mouth to feed. I don't need dead weight, Alidad.
He called me by the fake name I'd given.
Even if you don't hardly weigh nothing.
Parviz turned away, and already my heckler was stepping out to meet him.
You've a fine eye for business, my friend. Now I could take any of these fellows any time of the day.
He gestured in a wide arc with a glass of dark liquor dangling from his fingers. My gun was in my hand in a flash, ready to execute some half-formed plan. I squeezed the trigger. The glass in the heckler's hand shattered before the bullet sank into the wall behind him. The pit fell silent. The heckler stared dumbly at his handful of glass, blood, and liquor. Someone in the crowd burst out laughing, and then the roar of conversation went up again.
You son of a bitch!
The heckler had a piece of glass sticking out from his thumb.
You shot me!
No, I shot your glass. Don't worry. The liquor'll wash the blood off. I holstered my pistol, hoping I wasn't about to get shot back. Like I was about to say before getting interrupted, it's a modern age. I don't need a lot of muscle to pull a trigger. Parviz's eyes swept the heckler, then me. Traders knew the worth of things, and they knew when they were getting a bargain, too.
We're leaving from the West Gate at dawn. Don't be late.
Jin was at my side, pulling his shirt on over his head as Parviz disappeared.
Did you just shoot someone?
I got us hired, if that's what you're asking. I scratched the back of my head and tried to look sheepish. I was sure I wasn't successful, judging by the look Jin was giving me. And I only shot his glass. Jin hooked one arm around my shoulder, leaning on me.
I knew I liked you, bandit.
And then came that grin. I might have traitor eyes, but Jin had the sort of smile that would turn over whole empires to the enemy. That made me feel like suddenly I understood him exactly, even though I knew nothing about him. The kind that made me feel like if I was on the right side of it, we could do anything together. I had the next 6 weeks to find out if that was true. Chapter 12. We left at dawn with the camel's knees, as promised. I thought I knew the desert, but as I watched the sun rise in a perfect clear sky over an unbroken stretch of gold, I knew this was something else. The sand sea was huge and restless. The camel's knees treated it like something between a beast to be broken and a tyrant to cower in front of. I felt at home instantly. The landscape shifted from one moment to the next, the moving sands dragging me irresistibly down a dune one moment and trapping me in place the next. Some of the dunes seemed infinite. No matter how long we walked, we never seemed to crest them. The wind sliced its path through the land, scattering sand like shrapnel into my eyes and my mouth, in spite of my shima. In the middle of the day, the whole desert shifted, and a huge wooden structure appeared out of the sand, red and blue paint flaking off of it with the wind.
"What's that?"
I asked Jin, shielding my eyes from the sun.
"It's a shipwreck," Jin told me.
And just as quickly as it had appeared, the sand swallowed it up again. When we pitched camp on the first evening, my skin was raw, my whole body ached from walking, and I was happy. There were 60-odd people in the camel's knees, plus 2 dozen camels heavy with supplies and goods for trade. The years of travel between them were obvious. They moved as one when they made camp. "Is this what the real sea is like?" I asked Jin, taking my food to sit next to him on a darkened dune just away from the fire.
Jin had started a rumor that I was in a fire as a kid, so I was ashamed to show my face. I loosened my shima enough to eat without taking it off.
You don't have to walk across the sea.
He stabbed at his food with a piece of burned flatbread.
So what do sailors do all day? Lounge around, growing soft?
I poked him in the stomach, which was all muscle. I was stupidly pleased when he laughed.
Before he could reply, old Dowd spoke up from beside the fire.
Settle, children, and I will tell you a story.
The storyteller had a voice deep like the desert night and quick like the fire. It was a good voice for stories.
I wonder if he could set you straight on the moral of Atiya and Sakaar,
Jin whispered to me teasingly. I knew he was getting it wrong to annoy me.
Maybe he ought to tell the one of the foreign man who pushed his luck,
I whispered back.
In the new days of the world, God looked down on the earth and decided to fill it. From his own body of fire, he made immortal life. First, the clever genii were crafted, then giant rocks who soared through the skies from one mountaintop to the next, and wild Buraki who raced from one side of the desert to the other until the whole earth was full.
I wonder if God could save me from having to hear this story again.
A girl startled me, dropping down in the sand between me and Jin without warning. I already knew her. Yasmin, Parviz's daughter, the princess of the caravan. Isra, her grandmother, walked past and reached over me to smack her on the back of the head, making Yasmin's braid flip over her shoulder.
You will be quiet and listen, Princess Big Mouth.
That name worked, too, I supposed. Yasmin stuck her tongue out at her grandmother's retreating back before leaning toward me.
Old Dowd is telling the story for your benefit, you know.
She lowered her voice.
It's a warning for the hired muscle about the dangers that creep in the dark.
She waggled her fingers comically, which made the tin plate she was balancing on her knees almost tip over. She caught it before it could, rolling her eyes as she stuffed food in her mouth and talked around it.
The ones you're supposed to be keeping us safe from. Though it's been years since we saw a ghoul out here.
Same as Dustwalk, I thought. I'd last seen a nightmare when I was 8 years old.
It's mortal men that cause the most trouble these days.
Isra raised her hand, threatening a slap from the other side of the fire. The caravan princess pulled a face, but shut up for good, letting old Dowd lapse into the story. Everybody knew the story of the first mortal, but Yasmin wasn't wrong. Old Dowd did seem to be giving me and Jin pointed looks as he told it. So I listened close as he told of a golden age when only first beings roamed the earth. How, after time beyond counting had passed, the destroyer of worlds came from deep within the earth. She brought with her a huge black snake who swallowed the sun and turned the sky to endless night, and a thousand new creatures, the monsters she called children, but that first beings named ghouls. And when the destroyer of worlds killed the first being, he exploded into the first star in the newly black sky. God had made the first beings with endless life, so when they learned of death, they were afraid. That was the dawn of the first war, and as the first beings fell, the night sky filled. The Jin, the brightest of God's first beings, feared death so much they came together and gathered earth and water and used the wind to mold a being and set it alive with a spark of fire. They made the first mortal. To do what they feared most, but what needed to be done in any war. Die. So the first mortal took up steel, and with it he beheaded the huge snake who had swallowed God in his sun form. The sun was released from the monster's throat, and the endless night ended. The first beings looked upon this mortal thing they had made